Chapter 26, Year 874 PXF, Autumn. Thorn had not truly been out on the road since before his 35th birthday, when the Duke had promoted him to Knight Captain, and he couldn't help but be invigorated by having a destination beyond the horizon and a journey before him. Of course, he had to stay well off the main roads and paths through Elyon, and luckily, that spared Thorn from witnessing most of the destruction the rebellion had visited upon the region. Still, the magically withered fields and orchards spoke of the burned-out farmhouses and barns that lay over almost every rise in the distance. Thorn vowed to return and somehow help bring the land back to what it once was. But how long into the future he might have to wait, he did not know. Eventually, the ground began to rise beneath his feet, and the lowlands of Elyrian started to turn into the foothills of the Limehold Range, the ancestral homeland of the dwarves. Thorn began to trust using the roads as he got further away from his old life and deeper into the evergreen woodlands that spread out hundreds of leagues from the towering limestone cliffs and peaks of the dwarven capital. Even in his past life as the Duke's envoy, Thorn had never visited Limehold, as the King of the Dwarves dealt mainly with the Emperor himself via their Treaty of Accommodation. The histories he studied as a child marked Limehold as the oldest settlement on the continent and perhaps the world, the latter unquestioningly being what the dwarves believed. The city beneath the White Peaks was immeasurably vast, and cartographers more accurately described it as four cities, with Oldstone being the central hub of the sprawling metropolis. If Thorn were to plead for sanctuary as Castian had advised, he would need to go there, as that is where he would find King Stoneanvil. As Thorn traveled higher into the mountains, the seasons seemed to transition league by league. Where it had been early fall in the lowlands, the chill of winter was ever present when he arrived at the dwarven capital. The etchings Thorn had seen in his mother's books were but a dim reflection of the immensity and grandeur of the gates of Limehold that stood before him. Recessed into a 300-foot white cliff face and towering 150 feet high themselves, the massive arched gates stood open in all their vaulted majesty. Divided and subdivided into thousands of carved motifs and buttresses, the craftsmanship and detail were all but incomprehensible to the human mind. Still marveling at their grandeur as he walked toward them, Thorn, who had been rehearsing a way to gain entry to the city, was without even a question allowed to pass unhindered by the 24 ceremonially armed dwarven guards at the entrance. Thorn did not precisely know what to expect of Limehold, or Oldstone in particular, but Sunhall Cavern was absolutely not it. Dwarven settlements and stories had always conjured dark and claustrophobic spaces for Thorn. However, even accounting for this being their capital and on a larger scale, it still did not prepare him for the bright and airy magnificence of Sunhall. Utterly massive in size, far larger than Arnador's Keep, Ellery Square, and the whole of the Trade District combined, the cavern walls and architecture blended natural rock formations into an otherworldly and breathtaking tapestry. Thorn, having entered near the mid-level of the cavern, was awestruck as he realized the cityscape within Sunhall soared at least a dozen levels from its dizzying heights to its floor below. Still, without question, the most striking feature was the overwhelming presence of natural sunlight. Sunlight that was not magically conjured, but ingeniously redirected from the outside and focused through quartz stalactites and vertical columns of smooth, flowing, crystal-clear water that passed from the uppermost levels down to the river winding through the floor of Sunhall far below. If being a human of his size among a population consisting primarily of dwarves didn't set him apart enough, his provincial gawking and standing stunned in the middle of the thoroughfare certainly would have. However, after being jostled at least a half dozen times, Thorn finally came to his senses when a young ginger-haired dwarf wearing an official uniform and well-polished spectacles asked,
"Can I help you find something? A tavern or inn? I can recommend several that can accommodate humans of your stature." No, sorry.
Thorin had to jog his own memory as to his purpose, so distracting were his surroundings, until he finally could conjure out of his windpipe.
Right, yes, I need to see King Stoneanvil.
The young dwarf eyed him suspiciously as they stroked their thrice-braided beard.
What business do you have with the king?
I was sent by Castian Varro. He said the king may be able to help me.
Not knowing the nature of the favor or how Cass might have earned it, Thorin felt discretion was the best way forward, until candor was needed. The young dwarf knowingly nodded at the mention of the name.
Castian Varro, huh? Yes, I do believe the king will want to meet you.
Thorin wasn't sure what he might have stumbled into, but with his current lack of provisions and winter looming, he had few remaining options. The young dwarf introduced himself as Darvis, and a member of the Oldstone Historical Society and Visitor Welcoming Guild.
You would be amazed at the number of visitors we get to Oldstone. Even among residents of Greater Limehold, nearly half have never made the journey,
Darvis offered affably.
Not many humans, though. I guess the Emperor likes his magical forms of diplomacy rather than meeting face to face.
Darvis added the last bit distastefully, but recovered quickly by adding,
Don't get me wrong, I love a magical doodad as much as any dwarf, but over the centuries we learned that some things just need the personal touch.
Darvis led Thorin higher and higher in the cavern, explaining how many of the original first homes of the dwarves were long gone, now replaced by ornate guild halls, embassies, and residences of honored citizens. On these higher levels, Thorin even crossed paths with several dragonborn, who stuck out equally as well as he did among the dwarves, some being even taller and broader than himself. Following Thorin's gaze, Darvis did not hesitate to recount how the dwarves' and dragonborn's histories intertwined not only with each other, but with Limehold itself. They finally stopped in front of an unimposing open arch that, compared to the rest of the architecture Thorin had passed, was quite plain. Only two well-equipped guards stood to either side of the opening, who did not intercede as Darvis gestured for Thorin to enter.
This is where I take my leave. Good luck!
Darvis was gone before Thorin could even thank them, disappearing into the bustle of the thoroughfare. Thorin stepped through the arch into a dimly lit space, his eyes struggling to adjust after being in the bright sunlight outside. A long, straight hallway led deep into the rock, well-carved and adequate for his height, but just barely. Finally, after 100 feet or so, he came to an open chamber not much larger than the main tavern room at the Sojourn's Rest. A well-provisioned table, laden with food and drink, filled the center of the space, in front of a small dais, atop which sat a carved stone throne. A well-groomed older dwarf with salt-and-pepper hair and a single braided beard that hung long enough to be tucked through his belt leaned on the table facing Thorin. Upon his brow sat a simple but finely crafted circlet of Limdian. He held a frothing tankard in his hand, and with a grizzled voice he asked while gesturing with his mug,
"So, what has Castian sent to me this time?"
In the dim light, Thorin quickly spotted a magical effect flash into existence, illuminating the king's eyes as he examined Thorin. Stoneanvil's left eyebrow slowly raised as his eyes roamed over his visitor's form.
"Well, what you wear speaks far more loudly than any word you might say, so what is it you want? Speak plainly, as I have no interest in fencing with your niceties."
"Shelter. Sanctuary, if it comes to that, but I think most believe me dead, so I anticipate no one to come looking for me."
Thorn's words startled even himself. It was the first time he had vocalized how alone in the world he now was. In Talon's days with the Crimson Sentinels and Falcon's Grasp, no matter the risk, there was a shared pledge. Someone would always come, even if only for your corpse. Knowing no friend or ally cared to know the fate of Talancor Vermain felt like a hole had been bored in Thorn's stomach. Thorin wrenched his mind away from the thought in time to catch the king's words.
"You may winter in Oldstone, but I ask you not to travel to the outer cities of Limehold. There are still empty quarters in the pillars from the departure of the Dragonborn to found Shimandala. Darvis will show you to one.
Thorn was startled to find Darvis standing by his side, as the king continued.
Once spring arrives, if you wish to remain, you will need to find a way to earn your place here. But until then, consider yourself my guest. What shall we call you?
Thorn is my name.
After a pause, he added in the manner of the Uldani,
I have not earned any other.
King Stoneanvil gave a knowing nod of approval and of dismissal. Darvis escorted Thorn out of the chamber, but after he left, the king's voice echoed down the entry hallway.
And when you see him, tell Castian Varro we are even.
Darvis led Thorn down from the upper echelons of Sunhall Cavern, past the grand entry hall towards the lower levels. The winding path of ramps, stairways, and natural stone arch bridges over the river below took the better part of an hour. At first, Thorn attempted to act unaffected by the wonders of the cavern around him, but he couldn't stop thinking about how he wished Osman could see it all. He then realized that Osman had always been Talon's excuse, an excuse to show emotion, embrace joy, and be happy. Thorn decided he would not live this new life relying on outside justifications to live fully and as he wanted, and while not as exuberant as his Uldani little brother, Thorn gave himself permission to experience the wonder of Sunhall. He would later insist over mugs of ale that the length of his first trip down to the River Rock district was not due to his stopping in slack-jawed amazement and wide-armed proclamations of the vistas and artistry of the architectural composition the dwarves had created, assured them that it was. To keep Thorn moving, Darvis tried to distract him with some facts and details about where he was guiding him.
Below us is the Silvervane River, and built along the banks is the River Rock district. That is where you can come for meals and drink. While there are other options, if you have no coin, you can always partake of the King's Fare, which every brewery and food hall carries a version of on their menu.
Darvis looked longingly at the dwarves who were already gathering for their midday meal and ale out on the sprawling patios and decks of River Rock.
But,
he continued mournfully,
that's not where we're headed. We need to go upriver to the pillars.
Leaving River Rock behind them and following the wide boulevard that paralleled the Silvervane, Darvis led Thorn to a massive crack in the outer wall of Sunhall Cavern. Nearly 50 feet wide at its base, the vertical crevasse extended in a jagged triangle roughly half the height of the cavern. The Silvervane poured out through its center in a cascade of white water, while the boulevard they were on narrowed to a winding ramp that climbed into the darkness beyond. At the top of the ramp, the narrow passage, relative to the cavern's size, emerged into another enormous space filled with columns of stone, reminiscent of a dense ancient forest. While not as tall as Sunhall, between the lower light level and the pillars of limestone, Thorn's eyes could not discern where the furthest extent of this cavern lay. There was no sunlight in this cavern, but a soft, blue-green, rippling phosphorescence emanated from the Silvervane River, which had widened into branching and meandering streams and ponds throughout the cavern. As Thorn and Darvis moved further into the space, it was apparent that the pillars must be where most of Oldstone, and perhaps even Greater Limehold, conducted their commerce. Every pillar housed multiple storefronts and vending stands. Looking upward, Thorn saw that these establishments extended to the tops of the columns, and as his eyes adjusted to the rippling light, he spotted bridges and walkways suspended between the pillars high above. Thorn garnered a few second glances from vendors and customers alike, but Darvis's presence seemed to quell any badgering or undue curiosity. Thorn did not spot any other humans among the throng of people in the pillars, but many different species of humanoids were represented, and their presence seemed accepted and welcomed here. The deeper they traveled into the pillars, the more Thorn began to notice a deep roaring sound in the distance, coming from the direction they were traveling. Darvis chimed in without Thorn having to ask.
That's the Mist Market. Don't worry, that's not where your abode is. It's way too moist.
Darvis didn't elaborate, and Thorne didn't have time to query further, as Darvis began leading them up a set of stone stairs that curved around the outside of one of the limestone pillars. After no more than a quarter turn around the column, the two came to an open landing with a door leading into the stone face.
Here we are. A quite large ruby dragonborn lived here before heading out to Shimandala, so you should find everything to your scale, if not a little oversized.
Thorne was skeptical about the latter statement, as it had been decades since he didn't feel overly large and cramped in most indoor spaces. But he was quickly proven wrong. The abode consisted of three rooms and a privy, and while the scale didn't look visually off, Thorne discovered the difference almost immediately as he moved around the space. In the kitchen, not only were countertops and chairs at a more comfortable height for Thorne's size than he was used to, but they also seemed to be just a tad too high in some cases, giving him a strange sense of dissonance between his self-perception and the scale of things around him. As he explored his new accommodations, he was surprised to find a large balcony that opened off the central great room and stretched around to the main bedroom, giving an expansive view of the main flow of the Silver Vein. A small study with a desk and bookshelves completed the apartment's rooms. Interestingly, most of the larger furnishings in the room were carved directly out of the pillar's stone. Only a few high stools and a matching table in the kitchen were made of wood. Darvis chimed in again.
There should be a delivery coming with bedding and some essentials to stock the kitchen as a welcome from King Stone Anvil. You'll want to find your bearings sooner rather than later, though, as you will need to adjust to life here in Oldstone for the winter without the king stepping in all the time. I can usually be found in Sunhall if you need additional assistance.
And, like an errant breeze, Darvis was gone, leaving Thorne alone in his new living quarters. Thorne hopped up to sit on one of the high wooden stools in the kitchen, an action he had become unfamiliar with over the years with more human-scale furnishings. The silence in the apartment was both comforting and oppressive. The single small lantern in the great room did little to light the space, and the Silver Vein River's mesmerizing light flowing in from off the balcony seemed to dissolve away the walls of the rooms. Thorne allowed his mind to fall into the rippling light and reflect back over the day. He had assumed he would find some anonymity in the dwarven halls of Limehold, a place to hide in dark, cramped minds and scrape out an existence. A part of him felt he deserved some form of penance or hardship to shape the man who was to be Thorne, but that certainly was not what his first day presented him. Sunhall's bright thoroughfares, boisterous meal halls, and endless dwarven wonders didn't leave much opportunity for a lone human to skulk around. Certainly not one of his scale. Yet, strangely, standing out so much lent him its own kind of invisibility. He was another passing oddity in a place full of wonders, activities, and destinations for tens of thousands of people. It felt like his incongruency in their lives didn't even register with most citizens of Oldstone. There was a strange freedom that came with that revelation. Thorne was not only unbound from Talancor Vermain in this place, but also unencumbered by his learned and self-enforced tenets of Arnador and human society. It had felt so good to be like his Uldani little brother and embrace the experience of exploring Sunhall. Of course, in the past, Talon had sometimes leaned into Osmond's exuberance in their times together, but always as an observer or tag-along to them, not the instigator of the experience. His inhibitions had always chained him to Talon's role as Knight Captain, or even just the big, stoic, serious one of the duo. As unintuitive as it might seem, his being ridiculously larger, at nearly twice as tall as almost every citizen, gave him more license to physically convey his emotions as he pleased. There was no way for him to not be an outsider and different from everyone around him. Blending in was and would never be an option for Thorne. The dwarves he had observed on his trek through Sunhall had personalities far more expansive than their size, and he was free to be a personification of that on an even grander scale. Here in this city, he was unknown, an unwritten story in the lives of these dwarves, or more likely, a minor footnote, considering their long lifespans. Thorne felt liberated by that idea as he sat in his kitchen, finding comfort in the new and varied branching options it gave to his new existence. With a sigh, he smiled and relaxed into the feeling of dissolving into the hypnotic rippling of the light on his walls. Thorne's mind moved in its dreamlike state back to his meeting with the king. Some form of magical sight had certainly informed Stone Anvil's decision. But what exactly did he see? Thorne assumed his sickle would carry some mark of the conjoined god of nature. But what enchantment lay on the mail shirt he wore under his rough-spun tunic and threadbare cloak? He had no idea of what it might have shown the king. As the rest of the conversation played out in his head, Thorne came to his own statement that no one would be looking for him, and the emptiness it left in his gut. His mind had danced around the thoughts behind that emptiness, avoiding them at every turn where they appeared. Finally, long overdue, it was time for him to face the question that haunted him. What would Thorne do about Ryken? The question left hanging in his mind seemed to bring the world to a stop around him. Now asked, Thorne had to face it, and the ramifications of it. It was one thing for Thorne to adopt Osmond's zest for life and experiences. It was quite another for a 37-year-old man to shape his life around a love he lost over 2 decades earlier, when he now had a perfect opportunity and reason to leave that burden behind. Perhaps the answer was for Thorne not to erase his love for Ryken and its loss, but to carry it, much like his scar from Lachlan. An indelible mark inherited from the late Talon Cor Vermain, but not something to continue to pursue. Thorne chewed on that idea and tried to swallow it, but couldn't seem to choke it down and accept that as a course forward. The feeling from Thorne's own words, "No one is looking for me," kept that easier path, the wiser path, the sensible path, blocked to him. Thorne hated the emptiness those words left in him and could not bear to think of Ryken feeling them now. Thorne knew that it was likely Ryken had felt the impact of those words for the last 2 decades, when day after day, no one ever came. But just as he knew Ryken was still alive, Thorne hoped Ryken too knew Talon had been looking for him. And now, Thorne would continue looking as well.